This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The city of Bloomington joined with the town of Normal to increase the sales tax rate. The co-chair of the budget task force is still concerned cuts haven't been given strong enough consideration.
We're kind of fast-forwarding right to the revenues without having time to discuss cuts and create a process that makes us accountable as a council.
David Sage and fellow task force member John Zunick take your questions about the process, the cuts, and the tax increase. Hear how the community is coming together to celebrate the birthday of a giant in Bloomington's history. And if you don't think you know the music of Andrea Zahn, think again. She's backed up singers from George Jones to James Taylor. Bruce Bergethon talks with her about her new CD called Rise. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 22nd, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Community Budget Task Force has presented its final recommendations to aldermen and the community. Aldermen also took action on one of the funding recommendations in the task force presentation, a 1% sales tax. In the studio are Ward 2 Alderman and Budget Task Force Co-Chair David Sage and Task Force Member John Zunick, who has his fair share of dealing with government budgets as the retired administrator for McLean County. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for the invitation, Mike.
You can join this conversation at 309-438-8910. What are your questions about proposed cuts? Do the cuts go far enough? Is the sales tax needed, and do you support that sales tax? Give us a call at 309-438-8910. David, a sales tax increase came from the budget task force you co-chaired, but you had some deep concerns about it. You took a long time to push that button last night to vote for it. What were your concerns?
Well, my concerns, Mike, as I shared during our council conversation, were really twofold, is that I thought it was probably more appropriate to have both a vote around potential cuts as well as at the same time a vote on new revenues. That way we bring some accountability into the process. And the other part of it was, and related to it, was that I wasn't comfortable that we had had sufficient time as a full council to really look at the entire situation around cuts and funding. I get worried when things can get isolated and pulled apart, because I think part of our job is to look at the overall picture and make sure that we're seeing every aspect of it.
You went around, actually asked the council, you went around the horseshoe and asked them if they were willing to make cuts in addition to voting for revenue. And here's part of what Alderman Scott Black had to say last night.
And to answer your question, it's a resounding no. I don't think this council has the stomach to genuinely have the cuts conversation. I mean, when we talked about it at the budget task force, I mean, you saw some of the emails that we got, the conversation that we had was spirited. We speak in platitudes and in kind of very vague concepts of what cuts look like. And Alderman Lauer, you know, you're great, principled. You know, I know where you're at, and I appreciate that. And I that's one of my favorite traits about you. One of the challenges is that you have, at any point, an alderman can come up with a budget amendment to make a cut. But the real courage comes in making a coalition of four of your colleagues to convince us to do that. And I'd love to entertain some of your cuts ideas. But the first question this council will then ask is, we'll turn to David and say, what's the impact on staff? And then we will turn to our constituents and say, what's the impact on them? At no point have we ever identified a key program that we are willing to live without. Golf comes up frequently. How many times have, I mean, since I've been on the council, we've talked about it several times, and this nebulous idea of, you know, what could it look like? And then David takes it upon himself to look at Highland Park. You know, I've sat through some of these conversations where I have no idea what the conclusion is. I mean, how does staff know what we're talking about? He looks at Highland Park, and then there's blowback from the public. Well, we don't want to lose our oldest course. You know, we can't do this. And then there's some council, I don't know if I can get behind this. We are just all over the place, left and right. And there's no coalition here that I think would really genuinely look at the major cuts that would have to come from our structural deficit.
Alderman Scott Black from last night's council meeting. David, is he right? Is that an accurate picture?
Well, I think every situation, every conversation is unique, Mike. Hopefully part of what I think was work results, deliverables coming out of the budget task force. And I'll just mention golf, for example, since that's something that Scott mentioned, is that some of our recommendations are time boxed in the sense that there are a couple of I think, pretty definitive and straightforward acts that we're going to recommend that the council vote on. And we will be voting on all those recommendations here over the next few weeks. And
those will come out as separate resolutions?
Yeah, we're going to vote on them individually. And in that way, we can have give clear direction to staff. But for instance, as it relates to recommendations around, say, again, golf, since that's what Scott brought up, we have time-boxed a couple of very specific recommendations or ideas to see that those are done by the time we adopt the FY17 budget. So what we're trying to do is I think, bring a little bit more structure and form around these potential cuts to help us move forward as a council.
Did Alderman Black's comments give you pause as you decided whether how to vote last night?
Well, I mean, I always sit, and that's one thing I appreciate about our council, right, is we have a lot of interaction, and sometimes those conversations can be difficult. Recently, in a planning session, we had one of the aspects we talked about the council was that this idea of it's okay to have a spirited democratic process, right? We think there's goodness in that. We think that's important. The flip side of that is, as I shared at the task force a couple of different times, when you have those conversations publicly, it can be difficult to try to get to consensus. And so, one thing I appreciate about Scott is it's always his candor and his willingness to engage in parts of conversations that may not always be the easiest parts.
So you think the council has the backbone to actually, if a resolution comes down to says, we're going to close Highland Park, you think the council can get behind that?
Well, I think, again, Mike, It's always going to depend on what's put in front of the council.
This is a for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think understanding kind of the full picture, what if that is something that we're going to move forward with, and that's certainly some part of the conversation around golf courses, is then what do we intend to do with it afterwards? What is in this value proposition? If we're going to make a change to Highland, then what lies in the future as a benefit?
Golf courses aside, do you think the council has the stomach to actually make some real cuts?
I believe so.
Okay.
And I was even more confident of that after our conversation last night.
309-438-8910 in the studio are John Zunick and David Sage, members of the Bloomington Community Task Force. John, let's go to you for a moment. Member of the task force, from that task force came the sales tax recommendations, the same percentage that Normal approved last month. How critical was that sales tax vote last night to trying to help solve some of Bloomington's budget issues, do you think?
Well, I think it's important because one of the things I think the task force was trying to do, and I think they did a good job, is to try and balance the revenue issues along with the expense issues. And clearly, I think Bloomington needed to inject some revenue into the structural deficit. One of the things that's driving that, and again, this is a good example of where you have a state mandate imposed on a local government, and that's the issue of forcing local governments, particularly municipal governments like Bloomington and Normal, to fully fund police and fire pensions. And as a result, there is a significant amount of money that the Bloomington City Council, as a policy decision, set aside and said, we're going to meet 100% funding for police and fire pensions. That's a significant part of their budget. And the sales tax increase potentially gives them some resources to deal with that specific issue. In fact, a number of people on the task force said that if the council is going to look at increasing sales tax, they should look at it and have it be very transparent to the citizens that this money that we're going to generate from this sales tax increase is going to be set aside for police and fire pensions.
Not only state mandates, but a more nebulous sort of you're going to have to shoulder this responsibility when it comes to mental health. Both of you supportive of the portion of the sales tax going to mental health care?
David? Yes, I was.
And John?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a critical need in the community.
And are you both supportive of the property tax increase listed in the task force recommendations? Is that something that's going to become necessary, do you think?
Well, I think that'll be part of a follow-up, follow-on conversation that the council will have about each individual idea coming forward from the budget task force. Another part of the budget task force scenario was to look at updating the fees and for licenses and different things. I mean, we've spent a lot of time talking about our liquor license fee hasn't been changed since 1984. So what we really need to do is we've issued a contract.
Yeah, a firm is actually going to look at all of the fees from top to bottom.
Right. And this is not to make money, right? This is just to make sure that we're charging what's consistent with our cost and more reflective of the cost of doing business today.
We're talking about the Bloomington Budget Task Force recommendations. In the studio, our Ward 2 Alderman David Sage and Task Force member John Zunick. You can ask your question at 309-438-8910. Let's just back up for a moment. Let's review. The task force was charged with finding a way to close a structural budget gap. Can you talk about the magnitude of that gap and where it came from, David?
Well, there are any number of drivers, Mike. I think that two of the larger ones that we talked about, starting right with our first meeting with the budget task force, was to look at the gap around the solid waste program, as well as police and fire pension funding. And those two roughly were about $3 million of what was then a $7.5 million deficit. So those were the big drivers. So what we did was work through a process, have conversations amongst the budget task force to look at, for instance, activities with the solid waste program. I believe we've had more of a shift on the council the last few years, rather than just trying to have a kind of everybody pay the same flat rate. That there was a time when that worked. I'm not so sure that works anymore. But pay more depending on the level of city services that you receive. And the example I always use is the water bill, right? Not everybody pays the same water bill. Why? Because some folks use more water than others. And so as we started to look at that conversation as it relates to solid waste, rather than perhaps focusing on raising the fees that everybody pays for their refuse cans, you know, maybe what we did was to look at the charges around having bulk waste hauled away, because there's a lot of people who don't use bulk waste.
Sure. Well, let's stay on solid waste for a moment. The city currently doesn't charge for the first bucket. They're going to start charging if the council approves a resolution, may start charging for the first bucket.
That is correct.
Will that close the solid waste gap?
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is look at the current state of the solid waste program. Remember, back in June, we implemented kind of a pilot program, an approach, and went from weekly bulk waste pickup to biweekly bulk waste pickup. We're going to have some results of that. We wanted to have, maybe like 90 days of actual practical experience to see how that impacted the cost that we have. I will tell you that as a result of that, we've gone from 3 bulk waste crews down to 2 bulk waste crews. And so we're already seeing some labor savings. And I attribute that again to our public works employees and public works management working together to figure out how to do that.
Is the city actually realizing some labor savings? Did those employees go away, or were they reassigned somewhere else?
Well, labor savings
inside of the enterprise solid
waste fund. Yeah,
and that's my question, I guess, for John: is did the task force talk about why this was an enterprise fund and if it should continue to be an enterprise fund, or if general revenue dollars ought to subsidize solid waste even more because it's a public good?
Yes, that conversation came up. In fact, that was one of the issues that I raised in one of the meetings, is should solid waste continue to be defined as an enterprise fund? Because under generally accepted public accounting standards, if it's an enterprise fund, it should cover 100% of its cost. And there clearly is a public service which is provided. Again, that's a policy decision, and the task force, chose a particular way to approach this. And as David says, when they get the feedback on the changes they've made to the current bulk waste program, and then depending on what the council does in terms of a first bucket charge, hopefully that will address what's going on now in terms of the deficit, which the city's general fund is picking up.
309-438-8910 is the number to join this conversation. What are your questions about proposed cuts in the city of Bloomington, or do you think those cuts go far enough? And what do you think about the sales tax increase that's now going to go into effect in the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington? That number again is 309-438-8910. Let's go back here. We were talking about the task force. What do you think about the community budget task force and the process? How was the process? Was this something that was absolutely necessary, or do you think this is something the city, you know, should have maybe presented three or four budgets to council and actually said, here are your choices, decide?
Well, I
guess the question is, what is the value of the task force?
Yeah, and I think there's value on a couple of different levels, Mike. One of them was the engagement of some community representatives as part of our budget conversation. I mean, these are folks who are very, very accomplished leaders in the community. We had people who represented the Chamber of Commerce, people who come out of a large business background, a small business background, a non-for-profit. So we had a very nice cross-section of the community. So one was to hear their feedback. You know, how would this service change, or how might these revenue increases impact you in the private sector? So that was one tremendous value, in my opinion. The other, I think, really added value was to have a budget process, a conversation much earlier in the budget process than we did before. Before, what we've seen is a lot of times the city manager and staff works to prepare a budget. We see that in February as proposed. We have some conversations, but we're always then backed up against the May 1st deadline, the beginning of the fiscal year. Hopefully what we were able to do was to start that process in the fall and provide more direction to city staff in developing the FY17, the next year's budget.
And do these recommendations coming from the community task force help build council buy-in to make some of the tough decisions, do you think?
Well, I hope so. And that's my belief anyway. Again, what we tried to do along the way was to have several what I call touch point conversations with the council as we were going through the budget task force process, to let them know what we were looking at, what we were thinking about, to minimize surprises then when the final report came, as it did last night. And so hopefully because you know, I want to believe that because the council, we as a council had ownership and awareness and or ownership in these items, that should be a little bit easier to build consensus going forward.
John, as a county administrator, retired, or you worked for McLean County as administrator for more than 20 years. Did McLean County ever have a budget task force like this or need one?
No. Not during my tenure. We didn't. The county's approach was probably a little different, maybe, than what the city, what David described. What the county board would do each May, our fiscal year is a calendar fiscal year, so each May, the finance committee of the county board and then the full county board would adopt a budget policy resolution. And in that resolution, the board would be very specific in terms of setting out specific principles, policies for the staff to follow in preparing the budget. And that covered a wide range of issues, from the property tax levy to full-time employees to new federal or state grants coming in to our compensation schedule to capital improvements. Once that resolution was adopted, that was the template for preparing the budget. So my charge as the county administrator was to take that template and, in meeting with the elected officials and the department heads, to craft a budget which met the policy guidelines set forth in that board resolution.
So you've seen this from both sides. What do you see as the utility of the budget task force? What were the useful things that task force brought to this process?
I think what it did was allow people from the community who perhaps have never had this much interaction with a government budget to get a better understanding of what all of the components of a municipal budget are, and, as David mentioned, to bring their own personal experience to the table, to bring suggestions that perhaps city staff maybe had not thought of. maybe even the city council members had not thought of. You know, that's important, I think. And I think it helps because it allows the budget task force to say to the city council, we did have, you know, a broad group of individuals who, you know, came to the meetings, who spent the time, who looked at these issues, who developed this recommendation for you to consider.
David, where are the cuts in the task force recommendations?
Well, I think what we did was to try to look at provide a little bit of a framework around discussing potential cuts and tried to look at things from, say, five different categories. Program elimination, service reduction, shared service, alternate delivery, and then operational efficiencies. And so the recommendations are really, Mike, across all of those different categories.
Where does the recommendation for reducing aircraft rescue and firefighting at the Central Illinois Regional Airport fall to try to seek a reimbursement from CIRA?
That would come under shared services.
And so is that a cut, or is that something you're going to have to negotiate with CIRA? Because you're not going to, I would assume the city of Bloomington is not going to just cut off that emergency services.
That's right.
What if CIRA says no?
Well,
we're not going to reimburse.
We have to have a conversation with them, right? I mean, what I understand, Mike, after some period of time, you know, government spending can just kind of go on autopilot, mm-hmm. and once it gets momentum behind it, and there's not as many opportunities as there should be to circle back around and revisit those expenses. So what we want to do is have that conversation with some of the other service receivers of those services provided by the city.
Again, also talking about outsourcing golf course operations or reviewing selling golf courses or a golf course. Why not outright recommend the selling or closing of a golf course?
Well, that may be part of it. I think what part of the conversation we had as a budget task force was to try to find some consensus as a budget task force on items that we were going to move forward and bring to the city council for consideration. And so I think on different items, what we did was try to find perhaps some starting points, try to establish a foundation of where we could move the conversation forward with. But clearly golf is clearly at the forefront of a lot of those conversations.
And I guess a question for both of you, and we'll have to end it there. Do you think there are enough direct cuts to satisfy budget hawks in the community, some of whom you hear from during the comment section of every one of your meetings, the people that want Bloomington to cut something, like close a golf course or shutter the BCPA? Do you think that that's in this this task force presentation, and will the council move through on it?
Well, I won't necessarily speak for the folks who have ideas, you know, that they talk about with the budget. Again, what our charge was, what the council asked us to do, was to try and bring a balanced report back to them. I think there's clear understanding across the council that we simply cannot cut our way out of this deficit. And we can talk about where that, you know, how that happened, decisions that were made 10 years ago or 8 years
ago. And that's why there's
some
revenue in this report as well. John, yeah. Same question. Do you think there are enough direct cuts in this report to satisfy budget hawks in the community?
I think given the direction that the budget task force had, in the sense that we were required to look specifically at the general fund, I think there are. I think one of the things we talked about and one of the recommendations is that in the preparation of the FY17 budget, all of the departments in the general fund should prepare a budget which reflects a 5% cut off their current appropriation level.
Okay.
I mean, there are some issues that, you know, people talk a lot about in the city, but we're not in under our purview to look at. And so we weren't able to bring recommendations to the council on some of those issues.
John, David, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. I appreciate it as always. David Sage is Ward 2 Alderman and Budget Task Force Co-Chair. John Zunick served on the task force and worked as the McLean County Administrator for more than 20 years. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 53 years of serving musicians of all ages, offering band and orchestra instrument rentals and sales, a large sheet music department, and thousands of accessories, specializing in service to music education. Details at themusicshop.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of Bloomington Normal's most prominent citizens is celebrating a birthday, and it's a biggie. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
There's a big 200th birthday celebration for Judge David Davis coming up Thursday, September 24th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lakeside Country Club in Bloomington. Kathy Conley from the David Davis Foundation has been associated with the mansion since the 70s when she was a volunteer. For the past 6 years, she's been a member of the foundation and is currently president. She says this birthday party acts as a fundraiser and includes a floor auction.
And we're going to have a lot of items for silent auction. We're going to have period music. We have a faculty string trio from ISU that will be playing throughout the evening. We're going to have a special guest that will give a few words, very few, about Judge Davis, because there may be some people that don't know a lot about him. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a trivia contest about the Davises. And we're going to have craft beer and wine tastings and hors d'oeuvres. And it's a good time to socialize. And we hope make some money. And it primarily supports our educational and interpretive programming, but also the maintenance of the mansion, too, because being a house that was built in 1872, there is a lot of maintenance and upkeep. And, of course, the state of Illinois at this time is not able to fund us as they have in the past. So we have to step in, the foundation does, and support these programs and just deferred maintenance. We really need a new air conditioning system, but that's not terribly sexy. So, I mean, people really don't, you know, want to donate to that. So it's much more exciting to support children's programming. But we do a lot of special events throughout the year. We have car shows, and we had Civil War Days this year, Glorious Garden Festival, Christmas at the Mansions, and all of that takes money and people power to bring off.
Well, speaking of people power, Jeannie Reardon's going to be retiring at the end of the year, I believe. Now, can she be replaced? Is there going to be money for that? Or does the foundation have to take even more on its shoulders?
Well, the job has been posted, but when it will be filled is not known. At one time, several years ago, when there was quite a lot of talk of closing historic sites in Illinois, the foundation did step in to keep the mansion open. Interestingly enough, our attendance has been increasing, and our staff, full-time staff, has been decreasing. When the foundation was formed in 1986, we had, I believe, 5 full-time employees. Now we're down to 2, but our attendance has gone up. In the month of July, we had over 7,200 visitors. They came from many, many states, so it's really amazing how busy we are.
But you have to take the responsibility, the foundation has to take that on, the responsibility of doing these things with less staff around. Do you find you have to expand the foundation in order to carry such a workload?
Well, we have bylaws that limit the number of people, but if we have people that will step in and help, and we're very fortunate because we have a good board, it's a working board. Most of the people are employed. They have other jobs. So there's only so much time and energy that they can commit. But we're always out there trying to partner with entities in the community and to work through whatever we have to face.
What about the volunteers? Are you relying more and more on the people who are volunteering at the mansion?
Yes, we are. And of course, I believe that this is a trend that exists beyond just the mansion, but volunteers are becoming older and older. And we have many people that started 20, 25 years ago and maybe can't climb up and down stairs to give tours. So we have to try to recruit young. And we've gotten some really good young members, but we're hoping to do that more and more.
With all these dwindling resources, do you feel that you can continue to serve the community in the same capacity that you've been doing so over the years?
Well, we're very fortunate in that we had many of our school programs in place. They were developed by educators, and they meet the state standards So those have been developed and are in place. That really helps. And many of the programs that we've done have been researched, and the background information is available for the guides. So we're just trying to engage and enlighten, and we're very fortunate that we have a strong foundation for what we're doing.
That's Kathy Conley, president of the David Davis Foundation. Judge Davis's 200th birthday celebration is September 24th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lakeside Country Club in Bloomington. For more information, go to the datebook page of WGLT.org. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Another upcoming event for the David Davis Mansion is the McLean County Master Gardeners Plant Sale on Saturday the 26th from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Mansion Grounds. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A common health problem in pets can be more effectively treated if you just get a little closer to your animal. In this edition of Animal House, Laura Kennedy discovers how your nose can be the key to your pet's ear health.
Ears on animals are cute, whether long and floppy like a bloodhound, perky and furry like a terrier or a tabby, or sweetly tucked like a Scottish Fold cat. Ears make up a big part of an animal's distinct personality. In addition to being just downright useful, just as with humans, though, our pets' ears are open to a host of maladies, the most common of which, says Dr. Matt Fraker of Prairie Oak Veterinary Center, is allergies.
It's curious how when a human being is experiencing a problem with allergies, they're usually inhaling those allergies and then coughing, sneezing, eyes are running. Whereas when dogs and cats, and the pathology is pretty similar with both of those species, when they inhale their allergies, if they're allergic to maples, pollen, or grasses, or whatever, when they breathe those in, it causes a skin breakout. And often that skin allergy includes the ears. It's the same thing with food allergies. A lot of food allergies will present with primarily affecting face, ears, and paws, for example. So probably the most common cause of ear pathology we see in our field is ear inflammation secondary to a primary allergy that leads then to secondary bacterial and yeast infections. The others that we see, parasites, we see ear mites. Usually in younger animals.
How do they get ear mites?
I think the most frequent presentation we see is kittens. And these kittens come out of questionable environments where parasites can thrive. We see so many kittens that are adopted from somewhat outdoor, somewhat feral situations versus an indoor high-end cat breeder. But even there, sometimes once ear mites get established, they can be very difficult to get rid of a population. On an individual animal, ear mites are pretty easy to treat. So we do see some parasites that affect the ears. And in older species, it can be an area for tumor development and mass development.
How would we even recognize something like that?
Well, a lot of times, most of these ear diseases are all going to sort of present the same way. The problem with some ear diseases is the anatomy of the ear canal in dogs and cats. So in a human, it's a straight shot. I mean, if you take a Q-tip and go horizontal.
Which you will not do.
Do not do this at home. Your eardrum is basically horizontal, and the opening is horizontal. It's straight in. Whereas the dogs and cats, there's a vertical canal that goes down to the horizontal canal that then goes over the tympanum or the eardrum. And so accessing that horizontal canal is difficult. It's hard for us. We have to use a scope, an otoscope. We have to sort of get down that vertical canal and then over into the horizontal canal, which in a healthy animal can be unnerving and irritating. But when you have an animal who's painful in that area, it can be extremely difficult to really visualize what the specific cause of the inflammation is. In almost all cases, whether it's an allergy or if there's a mass present, certainly with some of these parasites, it's the same sort of head shaking, digging at the ears. You can sometimes get open wounds and lesions on the ears.
Oh.
So those are some of the more common maladies we see with ears.
What about wax? Is that something we need to be concerned about with our animals?
That's kind of an interesting question. More so with dogs and cats. With cats,
cats have, I think we've come up with this theme every time we do a program, cats have to make everything difficult, and they do with ears too. Amazingly sensitive to disturbance to their inner ear and their ear canals. With dogs, it is an excellent idea to assess ears at some regular period of time.
How regular?
Well, if you'll have some dogs who have ears that are perfect month after month after month. In that case, you really might just look at the ear once a month. Just set them down, open it up. I know owners don't want to do this, but it really is actually a good idea to do. Get up close to the ear and take a big whiff.
Oh,
and
whoa.
See, because a lot of these animals, I tell you what, if owners did this more often, we would catch diseases so much earlier than when we do. For instance, with dogs who have the flaps down.
Yeah.
And it will be like someday the dog shaking its head and the owner's like scratching, and then the owner will be like, wow, what's that smell? And then they lift the ear up and they almost pass out.
Whoa.
Had they been doing something routinely. And again, on dogs who have really good ear health consistently, it might just be once a month you take a look and make sure everything's okay.
Take a look, take a sniff.
Right. Now, when we get into animals who have chronic ear problems, dogs and cats, much better. Cats are easier to see because they have those short little ears, and you can kind of get a good peek into their ears a little bit easier. But dog health, dog maintenance, where we are going to try to employ rinsing on some regular basis, it really does depend on that dog's ear health. So if you take a Cocker Spaniel, a legendary breed for ear problems, even Cocker Spaniels with healthy ears tend to have a little bit of overproduction of wax in the ears. So just doing some routine cleansing on Cocker Spaniel ears monthly to weekly.
And we can do that at home.
Oh, yeah. It's real simple. And you don't have to be crazy about it. People, you know, you don't have to get out Q-tips and
bulb washers.
Ball washers, headlamps. You can you can really just get a...
Like you're a coal miner.
You're going to go spelunking in the ear. What you can do is just get your rinse. When you pour that rinse into the ear canal, it will actually fill like a cup. You can fill that ear canal up, and it'll actually fill like a cup. And once that fills, then you massage that ear real gently. And then you can just take like a paper towel on your finger and just soak what you can up. You don't have to dig. You don't have to wipe. You're not going to get to the eardrum with your finger. It's very, very difficult. And you can just gently push a paper towel in there or some other soft absorbent material. Soak it. You don't have to get all the cleanser out. The cleansers, most of these cleansers are creating a really nice microenvironment for the ear in terms of making it harder for bacteria and yeast to thrive, breaking down some of the oil and the sebaceous, some of the ceruminous material that we see in there. So in dogs, getting into figuring out what your dog needs for some sort of regular ear maintenance, And then doing it, sticking with it.
And use a product specifically for an animal. Don't use
Use hydrogen peroxide. Don't use, absolutely. We see a lot of things going into ears that probably shouldn't, and they're probably not helping. Now, cats, because of the sensitivity to having anything affect their ears, there has been some back and forth on, we'll see some cats with that just produce a tremendous amount of ceruminous material in their ears. And we used to always, you know, we'd see those cats once a year, clean them all back to ground zero, and then, of course, that would build up. There's been some thought that if it's not bothering the cat, if it's not foul, if the cat's not shaking its head, leave it alone. It's because you may get into problems trying to fix what is really essentially a benign problem. So with cats, we're a little bit more hands-off on ear cleaning versus the dogs. Now, when you get in these dogs, for instance, with chronic allergies, it becomes very important. It's probably the most important routine health thing you do is to stay on top of these ears. Because with these frequent bouts of re-inflammation with allergy dogs, whether it's food allergy, environmental allergy, people get into the trap of, oh, my dog's ears are bad again, calling their vet, I just need some meds, I don't need to come in, this happens all the time. What they don't realize is every time that ear flares up again, things are changing, things may be worsening, we may be getting a different bacterial population in there. And what we'll find, if we don't attack the allergy, the primary allergy, and a lot of people don't want to do that, they don't want to go through food trials to see if that's going to make this problem go away, which is a way to cure the dog. They don't want to go through skin testing. Some private clinics do skin testing. I'm still a huge fan of the University of Illinois. If you get to that level of allergy testing, they are the place to go for it. But addressing the allergy, the primary allergy, because if all you do
is try to take care of the secondary infections over and over and over. You will eventually start growing Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is this nasty, always resistant bacteria, super resistant bacteria. And once you get Pseudomonas owning an ear, management becomes incredibly difficult. So those dogs with the recurrent allergies that we're most anxious about staying on top of, cats will get recurrent allergies too, but we're usually going to be trying to back those down a lot more with oral meds, maybe some topical meds, but again, oral meds or injectables tend to be a little bit of a safer approach with cats than using a lot of topical stuff.
That's veterinarian Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. He advises that if you're at all nervous about cleaning your pet's ears, don't hesitate to ask your vet to do it. If your life could use a little more doggy lovin', why not consider getting a new furry friend? Like Norma, the Animal House Pet of the Week. Norma is a 1.5-year-old American bulldog with a belly that just begs for rubbing. Norma is a sweet-natured princess just looking for the perfect kingdom where she can show off her good doggy manners and walk proudly and politely on a leash. Yes, Norma believes in walking her people, not dragging them. If you'd like to meet Norma, you can find her at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for our Animal House team of experts, send it along to WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Everyone in the country music industry recognizes the name of Andrea Zahn. She's backed up singers from George Jones to James Taylor over the last 20 years. The release of her second solo album may widen her fan base. GLT's Bruce Bergathon spoke with the Central Illinois native about her new CD, Rise.
She's one of the most respected session and touring singers and fiddlers in Nashville. But when Andrea Zahn describes her new solo record, she's taken aback by the role reversal it embodies.
It's one thing to be a sideman, and that's my comfort zone, above and beyond just being prepared. You really want to make the artist feel held up so that they're supported and they have the freedom to take chances and to express themselves, and you're dialed in and you got them, and you know, you're there for them. And to be on the receiving end of that with people of that caliber especially was extraordinary. It's amazing.
Zahn's second album as a leader, titled Rise, drops today. It represents a major step forward for the woman who has stood behind James Taylor in his road band for the last 12 years. Zahn has also toured with country icons Lyle Lovett and Vince Gill, as well as the eclectic bluegrass and jazz ensemble of Alison Brown. As friends, Brown and Zahn go back decades to when they crossed paths in the world of instrumental bluegrass contests for fiddlers and banjo players. It was a world also occupied by a very young Alison Krauss, who shares her hometown of Champaign-Urbana with Zahn.
I love Champaign-Urbana. My family is no longer there. You know, I moved to Nashville in 1986. My father was a professor there at the university and spent some years commuting back and forth, but eventually ended up in Nashville permanently. And my mother had moved to Nashville permanently, and my brother. So I don't have family there anymore. I do still have some friends, and, you know, I've made a few excursions.
Do you ever run into that other Alison that is a native of
the Krauss one?
Uh-huh.
I do. Not as often as I'd like to, because she's arguably one of the busiest people I know. But but we do still stay in close touch, yes.
Alison Krauss may be the only major person from Zahn's past that did not participate in the new recording.
Shake it off, take the loss, let it float away, because it can drive.
Zahn sings duets with Vince Gill, Teb Moe, Mac McAnally, and Trace Adkins, as well as her current employer, James Taylor. The CD had its musical basis in Zahn's decision to record with fellow Taylor bandmate Steve Gadd on drums and the legendary rock and country bassist Willie Weeks. Together, they provided a sympathetic underpinning to a series of compositions that Zahn had been assembling over the decades since her first solo release. The unfortunate illness of her infant son, Leonard, provided a catalyst for her to finish many of the songs.
I'd been writing a little bit, but I hadn't made it a priority, you know, in those interim years. And then as Leonard, when he was 2.5, started exhibiting some symptoms, and we found out that he needed a series of brain surgeries, and he had a lot of complications. And for about 1.5 years, that was without question the priority, was taking care of him and seeing to his wellness, you know. But I found in that time, you sort of observe your life, or you contemplate it and make mental notes. And I try to make mental notes and come away a little wiser in the process. And as humans, we like to put things in boxes we can understand. You know, it's like, oh, that's what happened there, and that's what this moment was about, and that's what I learned there, and that's the observation I had there. You know, I mean, and I think that's where the songwriting comes, is in the reflection. So certainly in that experience, you know, it was unlike other moments in life. It kind of opened up a whole another realm of expression. So yeah, and it felt absolutely like the right thing to do, to kind of reflect on that time and the whole process and put it into song form.
There's a very beautiful picture of you and Leonard in the center of the booklet. Obviously a very special young person.
He's an amazing kid. And that's next to a song about called Let Them Go, about, you know, I think any parent or, you know, someone who loves a child, you know, you see them growing up and it's that bittersweet tug of you try to advise them, but you have to give them the freedom to find their way. And it's that bittersweet loving someone and letting them go all at the same time. So, yeah.
It's the little things that catch your eye. You watch them closer as the years go by. Every bird is born to fly. Let them go. To you, they're always gonna be too young. You always knew the time would come. They're gonna walk, they're gonna run. Let them go.
He's 7 now. Does he have a favorite song on the new release?
Yeah, I put together this little instrumental connective piece. It's like 1 minute long, and it's just this little viola thing for about 1 minute, and we call it the cat song. It's not credited that way on the record, but he said it sounds like our cat jumping around, so that was his favorite one for a while.
Let's talk about some of the taller guys on the record. very nice article about you in Rolling Stone, where you admit to liking to sing with tall, skinny guys.
You know, I didn't set out that way, but it sure has ended up that way. Yeah, absolutely. Tall, skinny guys tend to be really great duet partners, as I found out.
Well, the one with the lowest voice but probably the highest elevation would be Trace Adkins. Can you talk a little bit about that song?
I adore Trace. Yes, Trace sang on a song called Ship, which is has a sort of a Celtic flavor to it. And, you know, Trace is so known for being the consummate country performer. I mean, his stuff is so traditionally country, and he's fantastic at it, and he's got this cavernous, incredible baritone voice that's expressive and resonant and gorgeous. And yeah, he's amazing, actually. I don't know if everybody knows how amazing he is, but he's amazing.
They heard of a life on a new shore, free from the reins of all kings. Of hope for the weary, hope that only the new morning brings.
The duet with James Taylor, who is your current employer, probably was a special moment.
It was, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've worked with James for 12 years now, and he's one of those rare, special breeds of artists who's, he's such an incredible interpreter of music, but he's also such a, as we know, he's such a masterful writer and a brilliant guitar player, and his singing is flawless. And you know, I'm still a fan. He was one of one of my early favorites, you know, as a girl diving into records and sitting in front of the turntable listening to things over and over and over again, as young musicians often do. He was one of the first people to build the record collection, and it just meant the world to me. You know, I asked him if he would consider coming to sing, and he said absolutely, and we got to spend a day in the studio playing around, and it was a tremendous joy.
Anybody else would have just seen pieces laying on the ground, nothing worth keeping. Anybody else would have let me go, but you won't.
No,
you're like a potter seeing beauty in a broken vase, never throwing something so precious away. You put me back together and
singer Andrea Zahn talking with GLT's Bruce Bergathon. Her CD, Rise, is released this week on Compass Records. You can also hear her with James Taylor on his latest, Before This World. The music of Zahn, Taylor, and many other classic and contemporary songwriters is on GLT's Acousticity, Sundays from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. and 24/7 at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the Sound Ideas archive and podcast, including this episode, with help from Laura Kennedy, Bruce Bergathon, and Willis Kern. Also, thanks to David Sage and John Zunick for their time to talk about the Bloomington Budget Task Force recommendations. We want to know what you think of the interviews and stories you hear on Sound Ideas. Get in touch at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News.